We're joined now, I believe, by Zafar Bengash. Are you there, Mr. Bengash?
Yes. Hello, Phil. Yes, I am.
Well, very glad to be talking to you because there's some special news unfolding, and I want our listeners to get more insight into what's going on. There's a visit today by the Defense Minister of Canada to Erbil.
Yes, Erbil. And
it was apparently one of those secret visits. I mean, secret with the pictures and everything come out after he's been there. But and they say, and the headline says Iraq. But again, as so often, the stories about Iraq, when Canada's involved, seem to be have to do with the Kurdish area. So if you could tell us, why is Canada so interested in that, or why don't they spend more time in Baghdad when they have these visits?
Yes, well, Minister Sajjan, he's in Erbil, which is, as you rightly pointed out, the Kurdistan Provisional Government, which is a de facto independent state now inside Iraq. He went on a secret visit. In fact, he was there yesterday as well, and there he met with a number of Kurdish military officials, and in fact, the Canadian Armed Special Forces that are operating there, about 60, 65 of them, were also involved in a firefight because the ISIS terrorist groups had attacked a British forward post. And the Canadian forces went to their rescue. Mm-hmm. And as you pointed out, although the Kurdish region is part of Iraq, but unfortunately, since the 2003 invasion of Iraq by the U.S. and its NATO allies, Iraq has been partitioned. And this partitioning is de facto at the present time, but it is more than likely that the Kurdish region will not come under the control of the central government in Baghdad. Mm-hmm. And many countries that claim to be operating in Iraq, as well as in Syria, incidentally, they do so without the permission of the Iraqi government, and instead they go and they make their deals with the Kurdistan Provisional Government. Now, we know that even Turkish forces had entered Iraq and that region in Kurdistan, and the central government in Baghdad strongly protested against this, and they demanded that the Turkish forces pull out immediately, although for some strange reason, the Turkish government kept on insisting that the Iraqi government had invited us. And they said, well, the Iraqi government said, we have not invited you. we don't want you on our territory.
Yeah.
They said, no, you do.
What part of no don't you understand? Yeah. by the way, I mean, Turkish behavior lately, there's some debate about what motivates them. They shot down the Russian plane, and the question was the U.S. in on that? With some saying, no, that's Turkey trying to show off or make a name for itself or I don't know what. But then this happens, and eventually the U.S. says to them, well, maybe you should pull back. But they must be getting mixed messages from their NATO friends, right?
Well, yes.
Or maybe the diplomat tells them one thing, but the army guys tell them something else.
I think this is what looks like to be the case, because there is considerable evidence, and this has been pointed out, that number one, the Turkish planes, F-16s, that are American-supplied, were in the air long before the Russian planes went into operation over there. Secondly, Russia had provided the precise coordinates to the Americans as to where their planes would be operating in. And this is considered to be standard operating procedure in order to avoid any mishaps. Now, unless and until the Americans had provided this information to the Turks, their planes would not have been able to carry out a precise attack on the Russian plane. And there have been reports, these have been carried by Russian magazines, Sputnik, for instance, and one of their defense magazines. They've carried reports that the Turkish planes were guided by two AWACS planes. One had flown from Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, and the other had flown from a military base in Greece. This was the American AWACS plane. Now, AWACS planes, of course, are radars in the sky. So they are able to locate the precise location of any aircraft in their range. And, of course, Syria is within their range. And the two planes together had determined, in terms of the location of the Russian planes, as well as the coordinates that the Russians had provided to the Americans. And this information was then communicated to the Turkish Air Force planes that were able to carry out that strike and shooting down of the Russian Su-24, which is a bomber. And the two pilots that ejected, one of them, of course, was retrieved or rescued by Syrian as well as Russian special forces. And the second pilot was shot and killed by people that have close alliance with the Turkish government, the Turkmen. And so all of these things added together clearly indicate that the American military, at the very least, was providing information to the Turks when they carried out this act of aggression, incidentally, on Syrian soil. Russian planes are there with the consent and permission of the Syrian government. All the other planes and forces that operate there are doing so illegally because they have not got the permission of the Syrian government. It's a violation of Syria's sovereignty, their territorial integrity, as well as it's a violation of international law.
Yes, which, by the way, is the most important thing for our safety and everyone's security to talk about.
Exactly.
Who is behaving legally and according to international law? And this gets pushed aside by, oh, we're going to go after the bad guys. And we get to chase him into the other guy's house and kill him there if we find him, when he didn't ask you to come in his house and at all.
I know. This is the sad part of it, that very often international law is set aside, legality is set aside. Take the example of the UN Security Council resolution that was passed on Friday regarding Syria. It was passed unanimously, in which all countries agreed that there should be a political process, that the opposition forces should hold a dialogue with the Syrian government, etc. And the Security Council resolution did not say anything about the future of President Bashar al-Assad, because a number of countries said, or their representatives or their foreign ministers, that that is a matter for the Syrian people to decide, not for outside forces.
Yes.
It is only and only the Syrian people that can determine that. And yet, moments after the Security Council resolution was passed, we had Barack Obama saying Bashar al-Assad has lost his credibility, he has no more role to play in Syria, and he cannot be a part of Syria's future.
You know, that's the language of a monarch.
Absolutely. Who gave Obama the right to say that? I mean, you know, he has absolutely no business making statements like that. The ground realities are against it. In fact, repeated surveys that have been done have shown that Bashar al-Assad has far greater support in Syria than any other group. And I don't consider any of these opposition groups to be credible at all. They have no standing inside the country. They exist only because certain other countries, including the U.S., Israel, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, etc., finances them. Otherwise, these people, these so-called opposition groups, have no credibility whatsoever. And then you have these other armed groups. It's in fact not accurate to call them armed groups, they are actually armed terrorists because they are killing innocent people. They have caused a lot of bloodshed in Syria, and they have caused a lot of mayhem in Syria. And these people, of course, are beyond the pale. They are not interested in any peaceful resolution. They want to shoot their way to power, and they will, if they came to power, God forbid, I think there would be a massive, massive bloodbath in Syria. Mm-hmm. And we can see the conduct of these groups. We can see the example of Libya, which was, quite a stable country, when Gaddafi was in power, and once he was publicly lynched by the same armed groups, the thugs, the terrorists. Today, nobody talks about Libya, but it's a total. It is in total chaos and complete ruin.
Yes.
There is no safety or security for the people of Libya.
Yes.
And so, Syria is likely to turn into a much worse situation if these terrorist groups were to succeed. But I don't think they will, because now, as a result of Russia's airstrikes against the terrorist groups, the Syrian army has made a considerable progress. Last week, they took control of Homs. The terrorist groups were allowed to leave the city under a UN-brokered agreement, and Syrian government forces entered. And incidentally, there were jubilations from the population of the city, and they welcomed the Syrian troops. And people have started to
Why isn't it a headline here? Because this is a majority Christian population.
Yes,
they say the Christmas lights are out in homes.
Exactly, because people.
Why aren't we here saying, "Well, good for them"?
Yeah, this is the thing, because you see, this development goes against the narrative that is being pushed over here, and that is that somehow everybody in Syria hates Bashar al-Assad. He has to go. So they are simply loath to give any news or information that shows the reality and the true picture over there. Mm-hmm. So, here is clear proof that the people of Homs welcomed the Syrian army. There were actually celebrations for hours and hours. Mm-hmm. And soldiers and people were sort of, dancing on top of their trucks and their tanks and so on, mm-hmm. people welcoming the Syrian troops into their city after several years of occupation by these terrorist groups.
And as would be absolutely natural. Incidentally, that this thing about President Assad, you could say, as if you were a rational observer and knew anything about history, that leaders who withstand assaults by such maniacs as has been thrown at Syria and foreign powers trying to bring down a such leaders become very popular. Whatever they might have been before the fighting, their popularity goes up.
Exactly. In fact,
yesterday
and the day before, President Assad and his wife, they went to a church in Syria, and both of them were mobbed by people. The social media is full of photographs showing Bashar al-Assad and his wife. There are no soldiers around them. There are just ordinary people, children hugging him, men coming forward to shake his hand and hug him and welcome him. And in fact, there are statements by people. He went to the church and there were so many people there, they couldn't all fit into the church. But there are people outside who made statements. They said, "Well, we are trying to get into the church and we hope that the president is there because we would like to meet him and greet him." Now, these are realities that are taking place in Syria today, but unfortunately, they don't get much traction in the mainstream media, but yes. We do get this information from the social media, and of course, there are people inside Syria that provide us this information.
Yes, and by the way, one of the places to get this information, this is F.R. Benkosh, and it's crescent-online.net, crescent-online.net, where this reality can be seen. By the way, there's the SANA news agency, where you can at least see some of the pictures and material that Zafar has been referring to. Zafar, I want to ask you about Nigeria, because something really dramatic is happening there. But before I do that, if I could just return for a moment to the matter of the Kurdish region. So we know I think most people understand that the Kurdish nation or people are scattered among various states, Syria, Iraq, Iran,
Turkey.
And Turkey, of course,
yes.
Most importantly, because it's the stone in the shoe for
yes.
Turkey. Can you tell us, I've always find it, that we speak of these regions, but in the areas, I guess, of Syria and Iraq, well, also Turkey, who are the, there's not one leader, is there? I think maybe two or three. Can you identify who speaks for the Kurds in these regions?
One of the difficulties with the Kurdish people is that the three separate countries that you identified, Iraq, which has a Kurdish provisional government, and the Barzani family is in power there, and they're, of course, the best-known family among the Kurds. Mm-hmm. Then you have in Turkey, you have several groups, but there is also, for instance, you know, there was in the last election in June, when there was election in Turkey, one of the Kurdish-backed parties gained sufficient strength to have to gain 80 seats in the Turkish parliament, but unfortunately they lost those when the next round of elections on November the 1st took place, when the election was manipulated and Erdogan, the Turkish president, sort of, you know, created a very unfortunate situation whereby the peace talks, etc., that were going on with the Kurds were subverted. And he deliberately did that in order to rile up the Turkish people and to score points with the Turkish nationalists. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you have within that region the Kurdistan Workers Party, whose leader, Abdullah Öcalan, is in Turkish prison. Uh-huh. Then you have the Kurds in Syria, who don't have an identifiable leader, but they do have... There is a Kurdish movement over there, mm-hmm. and the Turkish government's attitude is that it does not want the Kurds in Turkey to link up with the Kurds in Syria, because then the Kurds would become much stronger, mm-hmm. and the Turkish government is trying to undermine them so that that would not occur. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the Kurds are not united. They don't speak with one voice, because if they were united, then automatically the Barzani family would emerge on top, because the Barzani family is best known globally. They've had a very long track record, mm-hmm. Even if it's checkered, of struggle for Kurdish rights, etc. So they would automatically...
Is it their region, by the way, that the minister, Canadian minister, visited?
That is correct, yes. It is their region, yes. And you know, one can see the way the Turkish government plays a duplicitous policy, that the Turkish government has entered into agreements with the Iraqi side of Kurdistan. It purchases oil from them, and it even allows oil that is smuggled from Syria by these terrorist groups to pass through Turkish territory to go into the Iraqi side of Kurdistan, and from there it is then smuggled back into Turkey and onwards to Israel and to Europe. This is how they make it kosher. You know, the terrorists are basically, you know, smuggling oil from Syria, and they allow the Turkish government and the Israelis allow these terrorists to make money by facilitating this this oil flow from Syria to Iraqi Kurdistan and then back into Turkey and on to Israel and other destinations.
Oh, that's a very important story. We're speaking to Zafar Benkash, crescent-online.net, and I really think I congratulate those who on Saturday, I believe, had a demonstration at Dundas Square in Toronto calling attention to this sectarian issue in Nigeria, where the army has apparently destroyed a major mosque, I understand.
That is correct.
And they've arrested a leader. Can you tell us what's going on there?
Yes. The leader of that movement is Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki. He's a very charismatic leader. He has unfortunately spent many years in prison. He's been in and out of prison. He had set up this this place called Husseiniya, and he has literally millions of followers, not only in Nigeria, but also in much of West Africa. And to give you an indication of his popularity and his dedication, first of all, what does he say? He has consistently spoken out against corruption in Nigeria, because unfortunately the elite in Nigeria are thoroughly corrupt. Nigeria is not a poor country. It has a lot of oil wealth, but I'm afraid much of that wealth is pilfered by the elite, whether it is the military or the civilians. Secondly, he is a strong supporter of the Palestinian people, and he speaks on their behalf. And there are, like, you know, as in Canada and in other parts of the world, people hold Quds Day rally on the last mm-hmm. Friday of the month of Ramadan, the fasting month. In Nigeria, such rallies are held in at least 25 cities.
Wow.
And millions of people participate in them. Millions.
Wow.
Now, the attack on his compound, his religious compound and his school, madrasa, etc., occurred on December the 12th, and the army alleged that his supporters had attempted to kill the army chief. Now, of course, the movement and its followers have denied this allegation. They say that this was simply a pretext to attack them. And they have pointed to the fact that if they had attempted to carry out an assassination attempt, how is it that not a single soldier has even been injured, let alone killed? I mean, obviously, the army chief was not traveling alone. He was with a mm-hmm. huge entourage of bodyguards and so on. So he said that nobody has been injured on that side, and whereas on this side, reports say that up to 6,000 people have been killed. Up to 6,000 people. Not only did they carry out the attack in the morning, but then in the evening, the Nigerian army brought its tanks, and it surrounded Sheikh Ibrahim's house, Ibrahim Zakzaki's house, and the operation carried on for 11 hours. The soldiers went from room to room, and anybody that they saw, whether it was women or children, they were simply shot to death on sight.
Mm-hmm.
They simply killed them right away. Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki himself was shot four times. He was brutally beaten up. We saw his pictures. His face was badly swollen. His face was bleeding. And similarly, his wife was shot. His only surviving son, Hamad, who was a teenager, he was also shot and killed. Three of his sons were shot and killed last year in the Quds Day rally when the army attacked the Quds Day rally, in which 85 people were killed, including three of his sons. So today,
wow.
all of his four sons are dead. He's badly wounded. His wife is wounded. And nearly 6,000 of his supporters have been killed. Thousands of others have been injured. Many are, you know, missing. Mm-hmm. People don't know where they've gone. And yesterday, the military again took its bulldozers, and they completely destroyed the mosque and the entire area, the compound, the entire area. They just simply bulldozed it.
This is not going to end well. Whoever does that,
yeah, absolutely,
it's like hitting a nest of bees.
Absolutely, this
is not that's the dumbest thing I could think they could do if they wanted peace. Let me ask you a big question involved in this. The U.S. seems to have had a strategy, and does have a very clear one, of dividing the Muslim community, and particularly trying to start a fight between Sunni and
Shia.
Yeah.
Now,
does this play into this? Are they showing in? Is there any Saudi or American or other outside interest watching?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Number one, the Americans are involved because they want to control the resources of Africa. Number two, the Israelis are involved and the Saudis are involved. The Israelis are involved in the sense that the Israelis have very, very close relationship with the Nigerian military. The Saudis are involved because within the Nigerian military and in the Nigerian state, there are a lot of people that have been bought into the Saudi sectarian propaganda, this Wahhabi nonsense mm-hmm. that has caused so much chaos throughout the world. So you have all three of them involved, and the fact that Sheikh Zakzaki and his followers were Shias, and they were gaining popularity over there, and that is something that roiled the Saudis, and of course the Israelis, because Sheikh Zakzaki was conducting these very, very successful pro-Palestinian, anti-Zionist occupation rallies in Nigeria, and increasing numbers of people were turning towards them. And then you had these corrupt elite in Nigeria that are linked with the Americans because they steal their wealth and take it all, put it mm-hmm. in American or European banks. So from the American point of view, and also we need to keep in mind that the Americans have set up this AFRICOM, this African Rapid Deployment Force on the lines of CENTCOM, and this is all linked together. Mm-hmm. And so Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki's movement was a strong challenge to these interests, and that's why they went in and attacked with the intention of trying to eliminate him completely.
Yeah. Well, based on what you've told me, I think that movement will become stronger.
Yes, absolutely, because you see, his supporters are not only in Nigeria, but also in the surrounding countries. And I also want to point out that...
And
you know, when
on the streets of Toronto, they supported him, too.
Exactly. There have been protests in New York, Washington, D.C., Toronto, Australia, you know, in many, many different countries of the world. And so in that sense, obviously, you know, this is not going to just disappear or die away. And and the fact that, you know, Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki has supporters in... so many other countries, I think this is going to be a very, very major sort of, you know, situation. Yeah. Now, I just want to point also to the fact that the Nigerian army has had a dismal record against the Boko Haram terrorists, mm-hmm. and yet they went after these totally unarmed and peaceful people and killed more than 6,000 of them.
Yeah.
Now, this shows where their loyalties and their sympathies and their support lies.
Absolutely. Well, Zafar Bengash, crescent-online.net, please go to that site so that you can follow this issue. Thank you very much for your excellent analysis, as always.
It's my great pleasure, Phil. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. This is Taylor Report, CIT 89.5 FM, and I want to thank Phil and Lucas, and everybody have a nice Christmas. We'll see you next week. Sur les uns, sur les deux.